The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Kingdom, though we're a little flock, we should rejoice that you've given us the kingdom and that we have been made as members of your church, both the community of the kingdom and agents of your kingdom in the world. We pray that you would enable us to better understand the world that you have sent us to as your ambassadors. And we ask this now in Jesus' name. Amen. All righty, let me remind you of what we're doing. We're looking this week really at the context. The whole rest of this course is going to be talking about what is the church. But you're not going to be able to appreciate what the church is unless you have a good grasp on the kind of world that the church is facing now. Now, we're going through that now. As I said, I think last time, the early apostles, for example, did not really understand what Jesus had told them about world missions until the Holy Spirit broke out with this at Samaria. And then they said, maybe we're not supposed to just go to the Jews. In other words, they had exegeted Christ's words wrongly. And what happened was events in the world helped them to understand better what the church was supposed to be. It is wrong to say that the world sets the agenda for the church. I think it's wrong to say that. There's a lot of folks that say it. It's a great slogan that the world sets the agenda for the church. No. But God sets the agenda for the church. Often, many times in history you can see, God sets the agenda for the church through world events. I've seen it many times. The Samaria thing I just mentioned, for example, last time we were talking about the poor. There's no doubt that again and again, whenever revivals broke out amongst the poor, the church suddenly realized that they weren't reaching the poor. They realized they weren't reaching the poor because all these poor Christians came flooding into the churches and they realized that they didn't fit. You can see that in the Great Awakening. You can see that in the Methodist movement. So the point is, the world doesn't set the agenda for the church, but the church, that God sets the agenda for the church very often through world events. We have to understand that. And that's the reason why, though, on Friday, I am going to talk to you some about some of the implications of what we're talking about last Monday and today for the doctrine of the church. But basically, I'm trying to set a stage. I'm hoping that as you go through and you listen to the lecturers come through, and they say, the church is the people of God, the church is the dwelling place of God, the church is the fellowship of the Spirit, you see. The church is both organism and organization. The church is both visible and invisible. And as they go through, if you've got in your mind the world that we're facing, at points you're going to say, yes. Now, we haven't practiced that much. That's true about the church. I've always known that, but we don't practice that much. And how much more are we going to have to practice that and come to grips with that in light of the challenge that is facing us? See, so the way in which you study would be different if you know the world that we're looking at. Now, I have rearranged all those. I told you last time 13 trends that I wanted to talk to you about. And if I give a trend and then say questions, I realize this isn't going to work. So I've re-outlined those trends, as you can see, I think, from here. We've already talked about this one. In the third world, there's a great explosion, population explosion. There's a lot of upheaval. And we talked about the fact that the results of all that is the rapid ethnicization of America, ethnicizing of America, urbanization of the world, that third world cities are exploding. It used to be that the so-called industrialized nations used to be so proud that the biggest cities were in the industrialized nations, and of course that's not any longer true. We talked about the migration of the disenfranchised, that the poor are moving back and forth from country to cities, from country to country, in enormous numbers. We talked about that. We talked about the shift of the Christian center to the south, that most of the Christians of the world are now or soon will be in the third world. We talked about political fragmentation and the growth of totalitarianism. Not necessarily communism, but totalitarianism is surely growing. We talked about that. Now, having done that and talked about the third world, I'm trying to focus now more on the Western or the so-called developed countries. mainly the United States and Europe and even the Soviet Union. Is what we mean when we talk about what I'm talking about actually even affects the Soviet Union, though to some degree less. Basically, these three things I'm going to talk about now really are effects that happen not just in America and not just in Europe, but even in the communist bloc, the so-called second world, you know, the first world, second world, third world idea. In a sense, I'm going to be talking to you about the industrialized countries today. And I began talking about them, and I said, first of all, I'd like to talk to you about two or three words that have to do with, I think they are descriptions of the modern worldview. I'll talk to you in a minute about why I use the word worldview, though it may be not in the same way you usually use it. Let's get back. I started this, now I really want to hit it. Secularization, privatization, and pluralization. The three words I get from Oz Guinness's book, Gravedigger File, which is pretty interesting and helpful, but the best way to read that book is to read his footnotes, find the books that he got the ideas from, and read those books as well. And then you've got a real course, a real good reading course on your hands. Let's talk about this. Secularization. We said, and I'll say it again, this is the worldview. It's carried like a virus. It's not the same thing as secularism. Secularism is a thoroughgoing creed that says there is no God, or if there is a God, he is not involved in the world, there is no supernatural, there is no life after death, and so on. Secularization is the worldview that says that religion is for the private realm, that there's no absolute truth for the central public sectors, and by that I mean, I can turn this off for a second, public sectors mean science, technology, corporate business, education, government, and the media, okay? Education, I mentioned that. Some examples of this, how is it carried? It's not an intellectual so much process, secularization, it's a social process as well, you see. You pick it up in many ways. You pick it up through the media, of course, but you also pick it up through bureaucracy. Somebody said bureaucracy is just technology applied to human organization. In professionalism, the concept of professionalism is that you never inject your personal beliefs ever into your work, nor does your private life and your private beliefs have really anything to do with your professional work. I the last two nights, I must confess, I watched the Hill Street Blues. They've started on Channel 17 to show all the, Hill Street Blues. I guess Monday night was the first episode from way back in whenever it started. What was that, 1978, something like that? And it's so intriguing. Joyce Davenport, you know, the feminist fantasy, the lawyer, beautiful lady lawyer who's tough as nails and brilliant and beautiful and everything. Last night, at one point, she was in a bar and there was another lawyer. Her boyfriend is a police officer, okay, Frank, right? She's there and he's watching another lawyer try to make it sort of a deal with her. Hey, do this for me, in court, do this for me. And he tries to slip her some drugs as a kind of thank you. Ferrillo pulls back his badge. The guy runs out. She says, how you have embarrassed me. Anybody see that last night? She says, of course not. You've got this course, right? You were working on it. Okay. How you've embarrassed me. And he says, I kept you from committing a felony. And she got in the car and says, I know how to keep my private life and my professional life separate. In other words, the law is for the public, you know, even the law, ethics of any sort, are for the public arena only, you see. I mentioned yesterday, for example, that there was an NBC executive that Oz Guinness quotes in his book that says, now that I'm a born-again Christian, it doesn't change the way I'm doing programming. It just gives me peace and satisfaction in my private life, you see. This is one of the reasons why that the born-again phenomenon has grown, why there is more and more and more people in this country, huge numbers of people that insist they've had a born-again experience and have all the basic, look, they have all the basic creeds. When you ask them, do you believe in God? Do you believe the Bible is the Word of God? Do you believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God? Do you believe in a heaven and hell? It's astonishing the number of people in the country that believe that. Now, that's not secularism, is it? And yet, as far as that belief having much bearing on the way people actually live in society, public morality and so on, it hasn't made a dent. People are wondering about that, you see. in Great Britain in the Great Awakening, when thousands of people became Christians, when they were born again, it had a tremendous impact. As many historians say, if it wasn't for the Great Awakening, England would have gone through what France went through, you know, a bloody revolution. But it had an enormous impact on society. It had an enormous impact on care for the poor. It had an enormous impact it led to the abolition of slavery. It led to the repeal of child labor laws. It led to prison reform and all sorts of things like that. That's not true here. Why? Secularization. Peter Berger, a sociologist, explains secularization like this. Secularization, he says, is a very distinctive mindset. Very distinctive. It's new and it's distinctively modern. All worldviews used to see ordinary life as one room or an antechamber in a much bigger world. Okay, it was a vaster, a very real world full of divine realities, and ordinary life was one room in that world. And it's our institutions in ordinary life, our ethics, our values came from the larger world, you see, and the larger world judged ordinary life, you see. What made that room meaningful was its place in the larger world. But Peter Berger says that larger world, secularization, means that the common sense world is a world without windows. Now that's a very, very interesting way to put it, and that's exactly right. Ordinary life is the only reality. If there is anything else out there, it's a concrete slab, you see, around ordinary life, and we have no idea what is out there. Truth, reality, God, beauty, those sorts of things. You see, we don't know. Nothing judges it from the outside. A common sense life, Berger says, is a world without windows. Now, that leads to, and these are concomitant, actually, they go together. That's the reason why sometimes I stick them together when talking about it. If religion has no place in the public arena, where does it? Does it have no place at all? And the answer is it does, in the private world. And let me, again, I'll go back to Berger for a minute, Peter Berger. He says that religion, the kind of religion that's tolerated in a secularized society, is a private religion. You're allowed to keep it in the private world, the life of leisure, of relationships, you see. Your weekends, that's where religion belongs. And what it ends up happening is all things that are meaningful, value, ethics, truth, beauty, religion, it's all found in the private world. And that means that personal identity and personal meaning is found in the private life, not the public life. Now, I'm going to get into I'm going to get into something that I'm really bad at. That's artwork. Let me see if I can do this here properly. Look. You see, the old idea was that there was a larger world that defined and gave meaning. Here's your public life, you see, and around it your private world. So you have different, there was a distinction between, say, family life, you know, out here. See, here's your public arena, your work life, and your different private lives. But as Peter Berger would say, in former times, no matter what your worldview was, before modern secularization, there was an overarching set of values that gave all of the parts of your life meaning. Your values were the same in your public life as in your private life, in your family life as in church, as in community, as in business, and so on, all right? And you generally, frankly, found your meaning in your work, in your public life. Now that's not true. I put it this way. You used to live in order to work. Now you work in order to live. You used to live, used to rest and have, you know, in order to get out there and work and accomplish something. Usually accomplishing something meaning finding your, you found purpose in life by accomplishing something that had to do with the overarching values, you see. Fulfilling the overarching values and purposes that gave definition to the common sense world. But now, that's not true. Instead, you find your purpose in the private world, in life and relationships. You work only to get enough money so you can retreat, and that's where you find your meaning. That's where you find your identity. That's the reason why the modern world is not only the most experience-oriented world, but it's the most leisure-oriented world. There has been an unbelievable explosion. I'm not that old a person. But it's astonishing to see the explosion of the entertainment industry, the movie industry, the health spa industry, you see, I mean, the sporting industry. The amount of money people put into leisure is absolutely astonishing. That's because it's the private world where you find your meaning and where you find your identity, okay? By the way, somebody said that's the reason why we have an age of boredom, because as C.E.M. Jode once has said, work is the only activity yet invented that man has been able to endure in any but the smallest possible doses. So the point is, privatization means, where does religion fit? It's okay if it fits into private life. Let me move on to pluralization, then I can give you an overview. These are all interrelated. They really are. My pluralization, let me see this. I have to do some artwork again. My pluralization, because there is no overarching value that holds all of your different worlds together. Now listen. Therefore, there's a lot of friction between the dissonant purposes and values of each arena. Your family life, your business life, your community life, they all operate upon different purposes and values. And so what you've got is, because you've lost this up here, what you really have, here's your public life, and here's all your different private worlds, you see, and they're all separate, they're not held together. At one point, okay, we said, a person found their meaning out there in finding purpose in accomplishing things in life that fit in with the purposes and values of the larger world. Now, you don't find, here's your public life, see, and here's all your private worlds, you find your meaning out here. You see, you find your meaning out here, in the private world. Now, this is interesting. Peter Berger, let me quote this. In pre-modern societies, individuals experience the world in a much more coherent way. Because of the plurality of social worlds in our modern society, each world is experienced as relatively unstable and unreliable. Okay? Because of all the different values. Each world is experienced as relatively unstable and unreliable. Thus, institutional order undergoes a loss of reality. The individual experience of himself is more real than his experience of any social world. Therefore, the individual seeks to find his foothold in reality in himself rather than outside of himself. Let me say that another way. Because the individual he's a different person everywhere, you see, like Joyce Davenport. A totally different person. If you ever watch Hill Street Blues, you know that she's a defense attorney, and she goes tooth and nail against Frank, who's a police officer, all the time, you know, in the public life, and then in the private life she jumps into bed with him. See, it's a perfect illustration of what we're trying to talk about here, all right? What happens is, because of all that dissonance, because every world is so different, the individual, it says, Peter Berger says, the individual is more real to himself than any of his social worlds, and that means than any of his social roles. And therefore, the individual finds his foothold in reality in himself instead of out there. And then Berger uses this as an illustration. He says, there's a big difference between the old concept of honor and the new concept of dignity. Honor was something you had in your covenantal social role. You see, I have honor as a man, or as a woman, or as a father, or as a husband, or as a citizen, you see, or as a public official. The concept of dignity is my freedom to not be bound by any social role, or any institution, or any covenant, or any obligation. It's my freedom, right, to be more real to myself than any of those other social worlds, which means I can pick them up and turn them around. Dignity means my right to fulfill myself any way I see fit, and no one has any right to tell me that I can't choose. That's dignity. That's different than honor. See, in honor, you found your identity outside yourself in the social world or a social role. Dignity means I find my meaning this way, by being free from any other obligation other than to do what makes me feel the best and fulfills me. That's the reason why MasterCard says personal choice. That's why I use it. Because I want options. That's the reason why the pro-abortionist people are not saying they're pro-abortionists and they're pro-choice. That's the reason for the divorce revolution. That's the reason for the midlife crisis. That's a modern phenomenon. You know what it is? We are, because we're modernized, because we're pluralized, we believe we only have meaning if we've got choices. That's the reason why half of the males in this room experience incredible fear when they realize, I may be getting serious with this girl. My options are being cut off. That's the reason why a 45-year-old man, you see, until you're about 45, you can sort of tell yourself, well, there's all these options out there. Who knows what'll happen? But you get to the top of the mountain at some point, and you can see it all the way to the end of your life, and you say, you know what, this is pretty much it. this is pretty much everything that's going to happen to me, and you can't take that, because you see, modern man finds his meaning in being able to be free to choose anything he wants. And he finds his meaning in his ability to break any covenant he sees fit. That's what's behind the midlife crisis. What he does is he exercises options. I've seen it. Buy a red sports car, dump the wife, find somebody else, wear gold chains around the neck and that kind of thing. You haven't seen that? It's ludicrous. That's the reason behind the whole rationale behind gay liberation, of course. You have to be free to choose. Why? Because dignity means you're more real than any of the social worlds around you. And the reason you're more real than any of the social worlds is there's no value structure that gives coherence to the whole thing. So remember, Berger says, in pre-modern societies, you experienced the whole world more coherently. Because of the plurality of social worlds in modern society, each world is experienced as relatively unstable. And the individual finds his foothold in reality in himself rather than outside of himself. Therefore, let me put it like this to you. Modern man, his identity is rootless and open, and he has an enormous capacity for social transformation. We change jobs, you change spouses, you change regions, you change regions of the country. It's unbelievable. And actually, people need that, because that's how they find meaning, you see. Their meaning is totally privatized in the private world, where I am free to do to have all these options, and I am free from any covenantal obligation. That's the only place I can find my meaning. Now, as a result of that, by the way, modern man is unbelievably conversion prone, right? I don't want to jump at every one of these. At every one of these points, you start to have to say, what does that say to us? When we think of ministry, we think of how the church is supposed to operate. What does that say to us? I'll tell you one thing. It does say this: that modern man is extremely conversion prone, but he's virtually commitment proof. He's conversion prone and commitment proof. You see, it's very easy to get somebody to make a decision for Christ. It's just like falling off a log. I'm sorry. You know, people want to be enriched. You know, people want God's help to get to their goals. You know. But as far as actually thoroughgoing commitment, that's one thing that they're absolutely—you're commitment proof, because the whole idea, modern concept of identity, is that I am the most important thing, and my freedom to choose is more important than what I am, actually, socially, or covenantally, or anything like that. Therefore, what does that say to us? Well, there's a lot of things that it says to us, but one of the things it says to us is church growth is easy. To a certain extent, and to another extent, it's probably harder than ever. Now, let me, before leaving this, and I want to take some questions, because everything else I'm going to show you, the radical individualism, the entrepreneurial explosion, the leadership vacuum, the dominance of the media, the single surge, all kinds of things, they all flow out of this. Let me just tell you, though, some of your little brains are starting to spin around. They're saying, this is an interesting worldview you're telling me. Now, what kind of worldview is this? Maybe you've read all these Christian books that give you these catalogs of worldviews. Is this hedonism? Is this existentialism? Is this naturalism? Is this monism? You know, you can get the catalogs. You can get the Ivy Press book, The Universe Next Door. You can get R.C.'s book, Life Worlds. Is that it? The name of that book? Now, the problem with that is this doesn't fit like that. Presbyterians in particular have always tended to do cultural critiques using intellectual history. They take these different abstract systems and they say, well, now which one's operating here? But there's more than one way to do a cultural critique. Oz Guinness points that out. Just to understand a culture, he says you've got at least three tools. One is intellectual history, one is anthropology, and one is sociology of knowledge. But what he means by that is, the way in which people are secularized is not just by an intellectual exercise. They don't sit down in a room and say, huh, this is much better than the old Christian worldview. It's a social process. They pick it up at work. They pick it up in institutions that teach professionalism. They pick it up from just the spirit of technique, you know, the technological society. They pick it up from the media and so on. The three things he mentions are, he says, to understand society, you need to use intellectual history and anthropology and sociology of knowledge. But now look, what is this worldview? You can see the intellectual roots of it. but it's more complicated than that. You can see, for example, some of you say, ah, this sounds like Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant, and look, there's the roots are in there. Immanuel Kant said there's the noumenal world and the phenomenal world, right? The phenomenal world is the sense world. It's the everyday common sense world. And he took everything out. He says, you know, God and truth and beauty and the thing in itself, you know, and ethics and all those things, they're removed. They're in the noumenal world. They can't be known. And what he did was he put all that stuff in the subjective world. And there's no doubt that the intellectual roots are there. And then you come later and you read modern existentialism. And when I was, just to let you know how different college world is now, when I started college my freshman year, I had to read Albert Camus' book, The Rebel, for three courses at once, Introduction to Literature, Introduction to History, and Introduction to Religion, same semester. That was an easy semester. Yeah. Well, and what he says there is, he says, the world's a cruel, horrible place. Hmm? And what does it mean to be authentically human? You shake your fist at the evil and the insanity of the world and you go down to a never-ending defeat fighting against it. In other words, good, truth, beauty is completely locked away. You see, it cannot break into the real world. And a perfect example of Camus' rebel is Don Quixote in the Man of La Mancha, right? That is a terrific existentialist manifesto. That musical, I'm not talking about the book, I'm talking about the musical. Don Quixote decides to be crazy. He decides, even though it's a modern age, he's going to be a knight and he's going to go off and he's going to fight dragons and rescue fair damsels, and somebody comes up to him and says, you're out of touch with reality and the facts. And this is what he says. He says, facts are the enemy of truth, right? And then he says, I've seen life as it is. I've seen men dying in battle. I've seen men dying under the lash. And they don't ask themselves, why did I die? But they say, why did I live? And then he says, if life itself is lunatic, who's to say where madness lies? And then finally, he says, maybe too much sanity is madness, and maddest of all to see life as it is and not as it ought to be. A concrete slab between the ideal and the real, between the noumenal and the phenomenal, you see. It's a concrete slab and there's no way over it. Now, he said, you know, he sings about the impossible dream, to march into hell for a heavenly cause. Now, let me just say this. I would take a good old-fashioned atheistic existentialist any day of the week over secularized modern man. I mean, there was something, even from a Christian point of view, there was something noble about that. And I happen to know that emotionally, at least, those people were prepared for Christianity. You could preach to them because you could say, listen, the ideal did become real, you see. There was one person, Jesus Christ, who did march into hell for a heavenly cause. There's a big wall there, but there's a door through the wall, you see. The noumenal became phenomenal. There's a way to do this. There's a way to deal with this. The good old atheistic guys, like C.S. Lewis was one like that. He lived in the myth world. He read myths, and in that world, he experienced glory and experienced truth and beauty, but he didn't believe that could ever break in. And you know the way J.R.R. Tolkien led Lewis to Christ. It's in Tolkien's biography. At one point, they're talking about this, and Lewis, who's still an atheist, says, yes, but myths are lies, though breathed through silver. And you see, there's the concrete slab there, and then Tolkien said, no, they are not. And that was he says, there's a myth that became fact, you see. There's a myth that broke into history. There's, you know, the noumenal broke into the phenomenal and so on. You could talk to a Lewis, you can even talk, you know, frankly, to a good atheistic existentialist, but what has happened now? See, secularization has taken that old, mistaken worldview, and it's come on down, and it's a real distorted, wimpy perversion of good old-fashioned existentialism. You see, you've got religion and truth and beauty is totally in the private realm, but what do we go into the public realm for? Not to march into hell for a heavenly cause? Not to go in there and go down to a never-ending defeat fighting against evil. No, you go in there to get as much money as you possibly can, to give into the self-indulgence, to basically make your killing so you can create the electronic cottage at the beach of your choice, where you can go into your hermetically sealed little private world, and that's where you find meaning, and where you're able to have enough money, basically, to use all those options, to use your MasterCard, you see. Where you can go into your hermetically sealed little private world, and that's where you find meaning, and where you're able to have enough money, basically, to use all those options, to use your MasterCard, you see, to chuck your wife and buy the red convertible if you have to. And the existentialism is the intellectual roots, but you see, it's more complicated than that. You can't just say, these people are existentialists, or what? They never heard of Kant. And besides that, a lot of them will sign the Westminster Confession of Faith, and they say, that's my confession. Now, everything else flows out of that. And I got 20 minutes to do that, but first I'm going to ask you whether you're with me. It really changes a lot of things. Yes, Ron?
How does relativism fit into that? Is that a synonym for pluralization?
Yeah, I would. Oh, no, it's a synonym for the whole thing. These things are hard to, you know, since there isn't, relativism is just a catchword to try to describe certain ways of thinking. It's a synonym for the whole thing, virtually. Relativism is saying, relativism certainly was, you can call everything that from Kant on down, as soon as Kant said all that stuff is subjective, totally. You can experience God in yourself, emotionally, subjectively, but we can't say that God has spoken, we can't say that God gives revealed truth, that God breaks in miracles and all that kind. As soon as you got into that, you're into relativism. So truth is relative. Ethics are relative. What's right for you might not be right for you. What's right for me, you know, that kind of thing.
So then pluralization is more just like the acceptance of all these different private arenas.
Right. Yeah, and then I'm free to go into any one I want. That's how I find my meaning. And yet, in another sense, you don't really even find meaning in those little private arenas as much as in your freedom to choose all of that. See, that is existentialism. Intellectually, existentialism says that you are precedes what you are. Existence precedes essence. That is, the fact that I exist, and I can create myself. I can authenticate myself. You see, I can. No one can tell me who I should be. That's intellectually sure. That's existentialism. But again, I'm trying to explain that the old existentialists, you know, just out of common grace, it seems like had a lot more. What they did with it was they said, we're going to fight against the evil of the world and that sort of thing. This is existentialism the same way. I define myself by my choices, but it's a real, it's an animalistic, low form of it. Yeah, Bob.
If the privatization of religion is a bad thing, how is it legitimate for Gordon MacDonald to speak of Christian life as a private world?
Oh, well, see, what he's saying is, and that's interesting, yeah. We got two things we've got to do. First of all, let's go one direction. We're talking about implications now. Almost all the discipleship material, all the stuff in which you disciple people, you know, the basic standard discipleship books and so on, what are they? They disciple you for how you live a Christian life in the private world. In other words, how to be a Christian on the weekends. That's what that should be called, most of those things. It says nothing about how to be a Christian as a corporate businessman or as a diplomat or as a lawyer or anything. And that is most of your week in many persons' cases. And an awful lot of folks are starting, you know, what's interesting is the parachurch ministries that are winning people to Christ who are professional are showing up here doing doctorate ministry projects and things saying, I have no idea how to disciple these people because the discipleship material just tells people how to be Christians on the weekends. And I don't even know how to begin. They keep saying, okay, I'm a senator now. What does that mean? Should I be senating different now that I'm a Christian? And they go, here, take this book. And all the book tells you how to study the Bible, how to pray, how to fellowship, how to witness. And please, those are the means. Those are good. Those are important things. But you see, that's a big hole. But now, what Gordon MacDonald was doing in his book is he was trying to say he was one person, and now, you know, in retrospect, we can see why. He was one person who had been such a public Christian that he had let the private world, the world of communion with God and my inner life, my priorities, my private life, he'd let that grow over. It become a jungle. And he says that's wrong, too. Obviously, the Lord is the Lord of the whole thing, not just the public world. When I say get into the public world, I'm not saying let the private world go either. And that's what MacDonald is saying. And of course, now in retrospect, we can see why he wrote the book. Okay. Let me show you the implications here in a little bit more, four of them. Radical individualism. Let me explain what I mean by that. These are trends that you see. For example, it's too easy, unless you understand the worldview, to chalk all this up. under here to microprocessors, to chalk it up to the computer. However, I want you to say, for example, we are entering into a custom-made society. Okay, even McDonald's do not all look alike anymore. Chain stores are dying. Mass dailies are dying, and instead everybody wants what? You know, these sort of little special interest magazines. Networks are being hurt for the first time, and cable. People want choices, you see, everywhere. 95 channels is what you want. Part of the reason of this is because of computers. It used to be if you had 40,000 employees, you had to give them all one contract. You had to. You couldn't possibly negotiate 40,000 contracts. With computers, you can. Even the old idea of long runs, you need, you see, the cheapest way to make clothing is to make 1,000,000 shirts, you see, rather than 1,000 shirts. But probably with laser computer technology and lasers, I understand that probably at some point you'll be able to make one shirt about as cheaply as you can make 1,000. And so what's happening, of course, is when we talk about custom-made society, it's a combination of the computer and the worldview, the pluralization and the privatization. So you see, for example, chain stores losing ground. You've got boutiques, little regionalized things. Alvin Toffler said, high-tech produces endless, blinding, mind-numbing diversity. The old industrialized society produced sameness. Everything had to be the same. Everything had to be standardized. But the high-tech society produces the diversity and the lack of standardization. Going right along with this is a general, I talk here about the entrepreneurial explosion. In the 1970s, two-thirds of all new jobs that were generated by businesses that employed less than 20 people. Whereas the 1,000 largest companies in the world, or in the nation, lost ground in the 1970s. You know, usually when you think of a job, you say the best jobs are with the big corporations, lots of benefits, job security, and that's not true. The entrepreneurial explosion means that people want to do things themselves. There's all kinds of do-it-yourself everything laid out. People mistrust experts. People mistrust centralized things. They want the freedom, you see. In fact, someone has said, because of the entrepreneurial explosion, that it's silly now to really, well, it will be silly pretty soon, to really be trained, put all of your training into a particular job, because the average person will have to change jobs at least five or six times because of change. It's happening so fast. What you need is, number one, English literacy, so that you know how to read, comprehend, express yourself, and two, computer literacy, and that's all you'll need. Then you have to get out there, and every 5 years you'll have to be totally retrained. So people are going to be less, willing to give things over to the experts, because they say, hey, give me the time and I can do that. Give me the time and I can be that. And the management style that's coming on, along with the entrepreneurial explosion, people like to work for themselves. They don't like to work for somebody else. And even in the corporations, the management style is moving to consensus decision making and people wearing informal clothes and non-specific career paths, so you get in with a company and you're not bound to just one job, but you can switch jobs around, and more participation and discussion and so on. I mentioned the leadership vacuum last time. In general, people are less and less willing to conform or sublimate their desires for the desires of the great, of the many. You know, and even though Spock said the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one, that's Spock. It's not the way we think. And that's the reason we have this incredible growth in litigation, which is a definite trend. And where does it come from? It comes from all the factors we're talking about. Let me talk to you about relationalism more briefly. Relationalism is, I put down two sub-trends underneath. There's this tremendous search for intimacy because of this desire for finding yourself in the private world. Frankly, the growth in counseling services, the growth in health clubs, the growth in leisure industries and clubs of all sorts is people's need for what John Naisbitt calls high touch. Any of you read Megatrends by John Naisbitt? He says there's a great need for high touch, a great need for the personal. It's part of it is because the in the public arenas it's so impersonal, it's so high tech, it's so quantitative that people are finding and needing intimacy more than anything else, more than they ever did. Somebody has pointed out, for example, that when they've done massive surveys of people seeking to come into church, when they say, you're visiting a church, what do you look for most? 20 years ago, far and away, the number of people, the most people who were seeking out a church home said, I want a place where my children can learn right from wrong and that kind of thing. Today, it's totally flip-flopped. 80% of the people are saying, I'm looking for friends, I'm looking for love, I'm looking for a place where I can be accepted. Totally different than, you know, they don't care about their kids. And that's really true. Have you just seen the Kathy, the little Kathy comic strip where somebody says, Kathy, you know, you're 33, you're not married yet, haven't you thought about wanting to have a child? She says, yes, I do think about it, but then I think about, I really like my life right now. My money is for me, my house is for me, everything I do is for me, my schedule's for me, me, I love it. And then her friend says, yes, you don't know whether you want to have a child or be one. And search for intimacy. Image dominance. The media will be more and more dominant because of the factors that we've said. Image will dominate. There's two different people in the early 20th century who had a vision for how the media is going to destroy us. There's Orwell and there's Huxley, and I believe that Huxley's right and Orwell probably isn't as right. George Orwell in 1984, his idea was that the elite were going to take the media and they were going to manipulate us with it. Did you see the movies, 1984, there's been two of them made, right? At least two? There's these great, everybody in their house has these huge screens that they're not allowed to turn off, and it was the way for Big Brother and the elite to manipulate our minds. Huxley didn't think that was true. If you read Brave New World, his understanding of the media was that the media would trivialize culture, would take everything of value, religion, truth, everything of value, and make it quantifiable and make it a commodity and reduce it, you see. So basically what Huxley was saying is, let me see if I can find it here, Huxley was saying that the media would reduce all religion, all theory, all art, all value, everything into commodity, and so trivialize things that instead of affecting the way we think, it'll just get rid of the need to think. And that's what's happening. See, everything is image. Joe McGinnis, was one of Nixon's speechwriters, made it very clear. He says the way a person becomes president, it doesn't matter what he is like, what matters is what's projected. People elect the image, they don't elect the person. They don't know about the person, they don't care about the person. And Neil Postman wrote a pretty interesting book called Amusing Ourselves to Death. He says, for TV to succeed, it has to discard reflection and exposition, and it has to turn that into amusement and entertainment. And so what you've got is never public discourse anymore. Americans do not have ideas, they have opinions. They are very different things. Americans do not have ideas, they have opinions. Instead of public discourse, you've got postures and symbols and images. Listen, do you see how important image is? For example, look at anorexia. As far as I can tell, that is a modern mental illness. Isn't that weird that it didn't used to happen? And now it's happening? What is that? It's an image problem. In fact, the self-image emotional disorder is a brand new disorder. Because it's not substance, it's not content, but it's appearance that counts. It's not work, it's leisure that counts. That's what I mean by relationalism. The changing family. Again, remember I told you, the reason the family is eroding is to a large degree because of secularization, but let me give you a couple of statistics. I already told you about the aging last time. Single surge. I suppose you know that the divorce rate skyrocketed from 1960 to about 1981. Then you may have heard that divorce rate is declining. If you look real carefully, the divorce rate has actually leveled out for people between ages of 20 and 45. However, it's still climbing for people younger than 20, and it's still climbing for people over 45. But ultimately, what does it all mean? Right now, if you're a woman in your 30s, and you haven't been divorced yet, 60% of all the women in their 30s who haven't been divorced yet will get divorced. 60%, that's in America. Divorce is still continuing to climb, and what that means is that, along with the fact that people, for various reasons, are not marrying as early, one of them is seminary, I know, this means, for example, that whereas you had, let me think if I can find this, in the next 13 years, there'll be about 1 million new households added to American population. 1 million new households. A new household simply means anybody living there. It could be one person, it could be a family. In the past, you know, 3 out of 4 households have a married couple in them. But in these new households, these next a million a year for the next 13 years, only 3 out of 10 of all new households will be a married couple. The rest will be singles, single parents, people living together who aren't married. That's a major, 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 major shift. By far, the fastest growing group of people in the country, fastest growing group of households, is single parent families, and in particular, female heads of households. You've probably heard these kinds of statistics. In 1960, 43% of all homes had a working husband with a housewife at home with kids. In 1987, 7% of all homes have a working husband with a housewife at home with kids. You heard that one, haven't you? In 1955, 10% of all households was a single person. And in 1985, 25% is. The most interesting thing is that leads to women in the workforce. As you probably know, very, very soon, most people in the workforce will be women, and it'll be very, very, very easy to work if you have children. Right now, about 50% of all women who've got children under 2 are working, and that's up 10 percentage points in 6 years. So, and the reason, part of the reason for that is because so many women are divorced as well. So what you're having as far as a changing family, every so often you hear people saying, is the family eroding? Oh, it's not ready to fall apart, but it's eroding very, very, very fast. One last thing, the economy of contrasts. Boy, don't have much time on this one. I probably could say something about this next time. You know the old thing about the rich get richer and the poor get poorer? That is very, very definitely true now. Because, for example, in the last 6 years, the number of households that have incomes over $35,000 has grown from 29% of all the homes in the country had $35,000 or more income to 34% in just 6 years. That's pretty. 34% of all the people in the country have got more than $35,000 incomes. However, the poverty, number of people in poverty is increasing just as rapidly, if not, it's increasing more rapidly. 38% in the last 5 years. Now, why? Now, I don't have much time. There's really, basically, let me see. I'll give you 4 reasons. Number one, high tech. You know, manufacturing is had it. 1950, 60% of all jobs were manufacturing jobs. 1985, 12% are, and it's on its way down. High tech industry pays high wages to people with pretty good educations, and it pays push broom minimum wage jobs to everybody else, right? An old manufacturing plant had a thing called a lower middle class person. A lower middle class person is a person without a college education and a lot of training who could earn enough money to raise a family on. Now, that group, the lower middle class, which is most of the people in the country, is actually being pushed. That's the reason they're being squeezed. Only 15% of the people in America have a college degree, okay? And that will probably begin to go up, and then it'll go down because college education is getting very, very expensive very quickly. Yet, because of the high tech revolution, only people with college educations are going to be able to keep out of poverty virtually in many ways. And so there's not going to be a lower middle class. It won't be long now. And that's one of the reasons why there's a growth in poverty. Secondly, the single parent family with a wife as the head of the home is the poorest single group of people in the country, and that is the fastest growing kind of household in the country. Thirdly, you've got a lot of people, you know, we talked about the ethnic explosion. Immigration is huge coming into the country, and many, not all, but many of the people coming in are very happy because they're better off in America than they were other places, but they're still living in poverty. And number four, the aging of the population. We talked to you about that, right? That whereas in 1937, 13 people paid into Social Security for every one recipient, and somewhere around 2020 there'll be 1.2 people paying into Social Security for every one recipient, and that'll totally break down. So when you take a look at the aging, and we haven't thrown AIDS in because we're really not sure what's going to happen there. When you take a look at the aging, when you take a look at the loss of the lower middle class, when you take a look at the increase in single women as heads of homes, and when you look at immigration, that means that the rich will get richer, the poor will get much poorer, much poorer, and there won't be much of a middle class. And that's the direction we're going. You might say, is it slow? Well, it's not too slow. It's moving along pretty constantly. That's what we call it, an economy of contrast. All these things are related, and next Friday, we will actually sit down and go through them bit by bit, and I'll be asking you questions. I'll say, okay, what are the implications for the church? What are the implications for the way we disciple people? What are the implications for church discipline? What are the implications for the idea of every member ministry? And we're going to see in many cases, a lot of these trends are both good and bad for the church. Okay, we'll talk about that on Friday. Thanks.